Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Blood River Radio family, just in case you're just tuning in, which you're probably not, a lot of you probably been on, hopefully you've been on for the 2 hours, but just in case you are just tuning in, we had a fellow I've been wanting to get on the radio for a long time, Don Black. He's a legend in the movement. I mean, if you want to call it a movement, a group of white Christian warriors fighting against global white genocide. That's what we do here in Blood River Radio, but none has done it better. The two fellows on the first hour, Don Black and Don Wassel. We're going to have Don Black back on again before too long because we didn't even scratch the surface of what he'd done. He talked about he started before the internet even came on. He talked about modems and things like stuff that I didn't even understand. I still don't. But Don was really a pioneer in getting the message out of our people. And Don Wassel has been there, too, since day one. They both were members of the Populist Party. Second, we're going to have them going again. In the second hour, everybody and his mama knows Monica Schaefer and Paul Fromm. So we've had a bunch of legends on tonight. We really have people that are actually legendary and icons in our group of people. And we have like I put in our show notes, the last one for the night, the last legend to be coming on, is the man himself. Nobody has put the message out there to refute the Yankee lies, the Jewish lies, more than our own Blood River Radio, Gene Andrews. What a stalwart, a pillar of Blood River Radio, a pillar of getting the truth out there, getting our young people to get their heads up, to take pride in who they are, to take pride in being white, and to help refute this damn lie that Lincoln in the North was trying to free the slaves and in the South was evil and all that garbage. Nobody has ever put the truth out there with more factual evidence than Gene Andrews. It never has been, and there never will be. And the man himself is on right now. I can't wait to get him on. It's such an honor and a pleasure to get that man on. Thank you so much for coming on, Bitter Ender, Mr. Gene Andrews. God bless you, brother.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that introduction. But I'm telling you, with having Monica Schaefer and Paul Fromm and Don Wassel and all the ones you've had on already, this is like you're bringing in the B team, the freshman team, to play against the varsity. So
you're a legend, brother.
I hope we can hold up on our end of the field here and give our listeners some information. You know, we try to tie in our Confederate history with the months of the calendar and what happened in May in 160-some-odd years ago in our war for Southern independence, to our struggle for independence. And that's we've talked about this before. While I'm not too fired up about this 250th celebration, because why is that so great when we're denied our independence from the axis of evil Yankee Empire? But anyway, we want to talk about something that happened in May of 1863, Battle of Chancellorsville, Virginia. And it's been studied by military historians all over the world as Lee's almost perfect battle, the way they pull this off. About 60,000 defeated over 134,000 U.S. Wow. soldiers, Northern soldiers. But before we get to that, I just want to use our time here for a second, and we'll probably run up to the first break, about my observation of our military situation going on in Iran. You know, we were told that if we attacked the Iranian military and knocked out their military, these people that had been protesting in the streets would immediately jump in on our side and finish off what was left of the Iranian government. Well, once again, the Yankee Empire has misjudged the will of the people. That, you know, they didn't like the Ayatollah and a lot of the religious leaders that they had, and they rioted in the streets, and a lot of them were killed. But they hated the Israelis and the Americans even worse than they hated their own dictatorship. And that's something that the Yankee Empire has never understood. And we'll give an example. We'll go back to our war for independence. The state of Missouri, when the war came along, was most of the people in Missouri wanted to stay neutral. They figured the fighting was going on in Virginia and Tennessee. It really didn't affect them way out there across the Mississippi and what was referred to as the Trans-Mississippi Department. And they were just hoping the war would pass them by. But then the Yankees couldn't let that go. They had to, John Fremont was brought in for command of the federal forces in Missouri and just came down on the people of Missouri with a iron fist. And he turned the state of Missouri from being neutral into a very pro-Confederate state. Now, true, the U.S. Army controlled St. Louis and they controlled Kansas City. But the countryside in Missouri was very, very pro-Southern after what the U.S. Army had done to the civilians there. And then not only that, they brought in the Kansas Jayhawkers across the border from Kansas to raid into Missouri and attack the civilians in Missouri, and which also infuriated the people in Missouri and drove more of them to the Confederate side in the war. And some of the more famous ones were Joe Shelby, Sterling Price were the commanding officers, but probably some of the more famous Confederate soldiers that fought in Missouri were Frank and Jesse James and Bob and Cole Younger. And they carried the war on after it was over against the Yankee carpetbaggers that were running things in Missouri. And they never robbed a Southern bank or a Southern train. They robbed banks and trains that were run by Yankees in Missouri that had taken over after the war. So they really continued the war after that. And probably one of the most famous people that fought on the side of the South during that war, if any of us had ever seen the movie The Outlaw Josie Wales, that was the whole point of that. He wanted to stay neutral or just stay out of the war and take care of his farm. And the Redlegs and Kansas Jayhawkers came in and murdered his wife and his children and burned his home. And that's where he went from just being neutral into throwing his lot in with the Confederate cause in Missouri and joined up with the guerrillas or partisans. And he joined it with a fellow by the name of Bill Anderson. And in the movie he said, my name's Bill Anderson, but they call me Bloody Bill. And boy, was he ever. You talk about somebody that fought the war with a vengeance. Bloody Bill Anderson and William Quantrill really turned against the federal soldiers that were trying to occupy Missouri. But the whole point being, the U.S. military misjudges what their actions cause in the end. And going into Iran and they don't know how many civilians our pinpoint bombing, as they called it, killed. And then the attacks by the Israelis who were just shooting anything they could into Iran and hitting targets all over the country. And whether they were military targets or not, didn't matter. They were just bombing the living daylights out of them. And so it seems like the U.S. military has a knack for just really pissing people off and turning them against the U.S. military and making them fight against them when beforehand they really weren't that, didn't really care one way or the other which way the war went, as they did in Missouri. And Kentucky as well, that was sort of a neutral state. And by the end of the war, Kentucky was very much pro-Confederate because of the atrocities and things that the U.S. Army had done to the civilians in Kentucky and certainly in Missouri. So I always think it's interesting. They always say those who fail to study history are doomed to repeat it. And it seems like our military and some of our political leaders cannot go back and look at history and say, this wasn't a good idea in 1861. Why do we think it's going to be a good idea in 2026? And that's kind of the situation I see now unfolding in Iran. They've stopped a lot of the military operations and put this embargo or blockade on them. But I still think the Iranian people would much rather fight against the Americans and against the Israelis than against their own people, regardless of what type of government they used to have there. So anyway, that's my little observation of current history and tying that into some of the history that we had in our country and what had happened. One other thing that I want to point out that people do not understand, they say that, the Confederates firing on Fort Sumter caused six more states to leave the Union and join the Confederate government. We had seven that had withdrawn peacefully and legally and formed a government in Montgomery, Alabama. And they sent ambassadors to foreign country. They printed money, posted stamps. They drafted a constitution. They elected a president, vice president, had representatives in Congress. And Lincoln said that you can't do that. Once you're in the federal empire, you cannot leave. And a lot of people, that was one thing that drove them out. So Lincoln sent a fleet to blockade Charleston Harbor and cause the Southerners to pay tariffs or taxes to the federal government. And that's why they opened fire on Fort Sumter. Fort Sumter was not occupied. It was being constructed. And then they transferred the federal troops over there, which thoroughly, completely blocked the harbor of Charleston. And that's why they opened fire on it. And we'll finish that up right after the break and then go into our program we're going to have for this evening.
Thank you, Gene. Be right back, folks.
Are you watching what's happening in our country and asking, what can I do? Join the John Birch Society in Salt Lake City, June 6th, for a powerful one-day conference. The day includes a host of respected speakers, two meals, and meaningful connections. You'll gain clarity on the issues and walk away with practical steps you can take to your community. Reserve your seat today at jbs.org/SLC26. That's jbs.org/SLC26.
This is Attorney Jason Robb, General Counsel of the Knights Party based out of Harrison, Arkansas, and proud supporter of Blood River Radio. I, like you, am concerned about the destruction of our beloved America and our racial kindred people and our cherished liberties. As an individual and as a nation, liberty is what we seek. Liberty is important. It is what allows us to be independent, and if properly used, liberty allows us to fully worship God in all areas of life. And with that worship comes more liberty. We are on the verge of anarchy in this country, and personal liberty is looked upon as a crowning achievement of the people. However, Christianity and white law and order is viewed as the enemy of this newfound freedom, and that is why it is under attack. Learn more by listening to Blood River Radio every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
Tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Dear Blood River Radio family, without further ado, we're going to go right back to the man himself, Bitter Eater. Go ahead, Bitter Eater. Continue on, brother.
Well, you know, Eddie, on our Confederate Hour we have on Blood River Radio, we like to try and correct history. But because so much of it that's thrown in our face in the South and conservatives and Christians is just basically lies and propaganda. And one of the things we were talking about before the break, we were talking about how the Confederates firing on Fort Sumter started the war for in 1861 and caused six more states to leave the Union. And that's not true. There were six states, Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, and then later on Kentucky and Missouri, that voted the Ordinance of Secession, and they didn't do it the morning after the Confederates fired on Fort Sumter. They did it when Lincoln called on those states to furnish troops to invade the seven southern states that had formed the Confederate States of America. And that's what caused these six states to vote the Ordinance of Secession and leave the Union. It wasn't the firing on Fort Sumter, like they always say. It was Lincoln calling for troops to invade the Confederate States of America. And just as an example of that, Governor Isom G. Harris of Tennessee fired off a letter to Lincoln and said, Tennessee will not furnish one single man for coercion, but 50,000 if necessary to defend our rights and those of our fellow southern states. And he had 75,000 written in there, and he thought that was kind of over the top on his original letter. He scratched that out and put 50. He should have left it in there. Tennessee furnished 130,000 to the Confederate cause. So that was one reason that they did it. And, you know, we've had historians that have told us that that's not really accurately, that claim that the Confederates started the war. And one historian said, the aggressor in a war is not necessarily the one who fires the first shot, but the aggressor in the war is the one who causes the first shot to be fired. And I've always thrown it back in these people's faces that talk about the Confederates firing on Fort Sumter. Well, if that's true, if you believe that, that whoever fires the first shot causes the war, well, then the United States started the war with Japan. And they go, oh, no, no, that's not when they bombed Pearl Harbor. No, no. All right, who fired the first shot that morning of December 7th? The United States did. The USS Destroyer of the Ward sank a Japanese submarine outside the entrance to Pearl Harbor. So the U.S. fired the first shot about 6 o'clock that morning. The Japanese planes didn't come in over Pearl Harbor until 8 or 8:30 that morning. So technically, the U.S. started the war with Japan because they fired the first shot. So then I always throw that back at them, and they say, well, no, that was different. Yeah, it's always different when they're trying to defend the empire. So anyhow, that being said, just a few observations. Free, no charge. We wanted to talk about something that happened in May. And we go back to the war in Virginia and the Army of Northern Virginia defending Virginia against the Yankee invasions and attempts to capture Richmond, Virginia. And after the Confederate government was formed in Montgomery, after Virginia seceded, they moved the capital from Montgomery up to Richmond because Virginia was the most populous state in the South at that time, had a lot of the war industry there. And really, when you look at it militarily, it was not a real good idea because now we had our capital only 90 miles away from the enemy's capital. And the whole effort by the Confederates were the primary emphasis on the war effort was to defend Virginia and defend the capital at Richmond, where if they left the capital in Montgomery, it would have spread the war out much over a much larger area and made it much harder for the Yankee Empire to bring the troops together to come through Kentucky, Tennessee, and finally into Alabama or try to come up from the Gulf. I think is, you know, looking back at it, the decisions being made. So I think that was a mistake the Confederates made, was moving the capital up to Richmond. Now, Richmond would have been an important city, but it wouldn't have had the emphasis or the determination of the federal empire to attack Richmond as just another city and not the capital of the Confederacy. So that being said, Lee's army and the Army of Northern Virginia did a masterful job with what they had, defeating these attempts by the U.S. Army to move into Virginia and take the capital at Richmond. The thing was, on this strategy, and you can always look back as a Monday morning quarterback and decide what should have been done, and I coached high school football for 14 years, and I was undefeated on Monday morning. I never lost a game on Monday morning going back and looking at the film over the weekend and figured out what we did wrong. The problem was, as an offensive coordinator, I didn't have all that information on Friday night. Now, if I'd have had the information that we got on Monday morning on Friday night, we might have had a lot better records in those years. But as a Monday morning quarterback, I was absolutely undefeated. And the same thing here, looking back on it, of trying to spread the federal army out and make them go through the central part of the Confederacy rather than just concentrate everything in the east. And Lee won a lot of battles, and he defeated the federal army. The problem was, and this is what they were hoping was going to happen, it never did, though, that Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia would completely destroy the federal Army of the Potomac. That was their main eastern army. Destroy the Army of the Potomac, march on Washington, threaten Washington, and the war would be over. And they'd say, okay, we won't burn Washington like the British did if you grant us our independence. That never happened. Lee won a lot of battles, but they never could destroy the Army of the Potomac. And after Gettysburg in July of 1863, the Confederate Army in Virginia was fighting just mainly defensive battles. They never had the numbers to go out and destroy Grant or the federal army that had come into Virginia. So it turned into a war of attrition, which we could never win. We never had the numbers to just have these huge bloodlettings and then eventually bleed out the North and win the war. One of the battles, though, we're going to talk about today was fought in May of 1863, and it was at a place in Virginia called the Wilderness, and it was overgrown timber. They'd cut a lot of timber there for furnaces, for iron furnaces, and it had regrown, and it really was a wilderness or a jungle. There were very few roads through that part of Virginia, and in the roads that were there, you couldn't see 20 yards off the road because of the thick underbrush. In December the previous year, in 1862, Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia had defeated Ambrose P. Burnside and the Union Army at Fredericksburg, Virginia. And that's on the Rappahannock River up north of Richmond. Burnside tried crossing the river, and Jeb Stuart's cavalry had reported to Lee that there was a crossing at Fredericksburg. Lee pulled his troops together, and they occupied the high ground to the west of the Rappahannock River, and Burnside just launched his army in these suicidal attacks and just got them slaughtered trying to come up those heights. Burnside was replaced. They brought in Joseph Hooker to command the Federal Army after Burnside's disaster at Fredericksburg. And he entitled himself Fighting Joe Hooker. And he was pretty bombastic and quite a braggart. He also had another reputation. He had a reputation for rather unsavory goings-on with women in the Army as professional women. And today, and back then, they were known as Hooker's women. And so today, we have the term hookers, which applies to prostitutes or professional women. And it came from Fighting Joe Hooker, commander of the Federal Army of the Potomac. But anyway, he moved the Federal Army north away from Fredericksburg, where Burnside had him, and swung around Lee's army to the north and crossed the Rapidan River. Now, if you look at a map or if we have it in our heads, the Rappahannock runs kind of north and south up past Fredericksburg. And then up north of that, the Rapidan runs from west to east and flows into the Rappahannock River. So Hooker moved the army up past the Rapidan and came down and almost in the rear of Lee's army. So Lee was caught in a pretty tough spot. His army was greatly outnumbered. They had about 60,000 to face Hooker's 134,000. Part of his army under James Longstreet, two of his divisions, George Pickett and John Hood, had gone down toward Suffolk, Virginia, to try to retake Norfolk and at least trying to bring in some supplies and forage to the Army of Northern Virginia was starving. But anyway, so his army was greatly reduced in numbers. And rather than go on the defensive and be trapped between two wings of the Federal Army, Hooker took most of his army up north of Lee's army, left Sedgwick's corps down there at Fredericksburg to threaten Lee from the east. And now he had most of his army up north of Lee. So Lee was actually caught between two wings of the Federal Army. So rather than trying to take a defensive position there in the wilderness or close to the Chancellor home in a little crossroads there that was called Chancellorsville, which is no more than just a few buildings, Lee decided to go on the attack. He once again divided his army, and he had found out through Jeb Stuart's cavalry that part of the Federal Army was spread out in a long line, and they had their flank kind of, they called it hanging in the air. O.O. Howard and the 11th Corps were to the west of Hooker's main army, but they were just in a line along the Chancellor Road or Chancellorsville Road. They had no protection on their flank. Their line ran kind of from west to east, and they were just stuck out there pretty much by themselves. So Lee's decision, from the information that Jeb Stuart's cavalry gave him about this, decided to split his army up again and send his second corps commander, Thomas Jackson, Stonewall Jackson, to march around and catch Hooker's army that was spread out. And we'll talk about how the battle unfolded after the break.
Man, I can't wait to hear that. Be right back, folks. I know you want to hear it too.
Would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
Breaking news this hour from Town Hall. Amit Thomason. President Trump's China summit may be in the rearview mirror now, but one unresolved issue is that proposed major American arms sale to Taiwan.
The arms sale, this one, is worth about $12 billion. It was actually approved by congressional leaders back in January, but then held up by the White House, likely in anticipation of this summit with President Xi. It's not just Taiwan that would like to see this sale finally approved. A bipartisan group of senators here in the U.S. earlier this month urged the Trump administration to push this deal through. The key thing to look out for will be, will Trump approve this arms sale, or will President Xi have had an effect on that very material bit of support for Taiwan?
The BBC's Joel Gunter in Washington. Monday is going to be a whole different ball game for a lot of New York area commuters left high and dry by a rail strike.
Hundreds of thousands of commuters in and around New York are left figuring out how they will get around without the Long Island Railroad after a strike by workers shut down the nation's busiest rail system Saturday. Union rep Kevin Sexton.
We're far apart at this point.
They were negotiating pay and other benefits with the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. Chairman Jana Lieber.
We cannot responsibly make a deal that implodes the MTA's budget.
The first LIRR strike in decades comes as many were relying on the system for the Yankees and Mets subway series and a Bruce Springsteen concert at Madison Square Garden. Julie Walker, New York.
In Louisiana, a three-way race in a Republican U.S. Senate primary. Voters are casting ballots today, deciding between incumbent Senator Bill Cassidy, State Treasurer, one-time Trump aide John Fleming, and GOP Congresswoman Julia Letlow, endorsed by President Trump. More on these stories, townhall.com.
Larry Elder here. You know, I think a lot of people just accept pain, like, this is just how it is now. I don't think that has to be true. Let me tell you about George. He's up in Oregon, works 10-hour days driving a garbage truck in and out all day. It really did a number on his knee. He said it got so bad, he couldn't even bend it. Now think about that. Trying to work, take care of your family, and your body just isn't cooperating. Well, George tried Relief Factor, and this is what got me. He said, I can bend my knee again with very little pain. Simple, but when you get something like that back, it matters. My brother Kirk had difficulty going up and down the stairs in the morning until he followed my advice. After about a week, he calls and says, this stuff is working. If you're dealing with aches and pains, see if Relief Factor works for you. It's drug-free with a three-week quick start for just $19.95. Go to ReliefFactor.com. That's ReliefFactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF. You don't have to just accept living with pain.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, if those people, referring to the dictatorial federal government, if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home. As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
smell of napalm in the morning. Smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue.
Dear Blood River Radio family, one of the few regrets I have about this program is you can't hear what's going on during the break. Gene just gave an amazing history lesson during the break. I wish we had another hour. Oh, my Lord, have mercy. It's such a treat, but I got to shut up. We're getting ready to go back to one of my favorite parts of the program. So go ahead, Bitterender.
Okay, so we're talking about how Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia were caught between two massive federal forces, one behind him on the east side of the Rappahannock River across from Fredericksburg, Virginia. And then the main federal army had swung around to the north and crossed the Rapidan River and now it's coming down on Lee from the north. And so rather than try to take a defensive position and be attacked from two directions at once, Lee decided to go on the offensive. And Jeb Stuart's cavalry had found in the federal lines that their right flank or western flank and the 11th Corps under O.O. Howard was just stuck out in the woods pretty much by themselves. And so Lee decided that he would split his army again in front of a huge force that was much larger than he was if he had the whole army all together. He was going to split his army again and send Thomas Jackson, Stonewall Jackson, and his army corps on a westward march south and then west and then swing around and come back east and attack this 11th Corps that was just sitting out by themselves. So they found some local boys that could show them a route that they could take back kind of southwest through the woods where the federal army couldn't observe them and then turn around and come back to the east and capture the federal army on this flank march of 16 miles on May the 1st. So they started before sunrise on May the 1st, make it a 16-mile march, and swung around behind the federal army that was spread out along the Chancellorsville Road, or the little, just is a crossroads all it was. It wasn't really a town at all, Chancellorsville. So Lee now had only 17,000 to face Hooker's army, 140,000, and they continued to make demonstrations or attacks against Hooker's forces, who now, Hooker lost his nerve. He called himself Fighting Joe Hooker, but he kind of lost his nerve and was digging in on a defensive line in all the woods there in the wilderness. So Jackson had about 26,000 men with from Lee's army, and they left before sunrise, and about 6 p.m. that afternoon on May the 1st, they launched their attack. They came on, they went online in the woods, got everything organized, and launched their attack about 6 p.m., and it completely caught the Howard's 11th Corps off guard. They were preparing supper, and they figured, you know, they could hear firing way away from them over to the east, and they figured, you know, that they were pounding on Lee and the battle would be over by tomorrow, sundown the next day, because they knew they had Lee outnumbered. And they had no clue that there was entire Confederate Corps lining up in the woods just to the west of them. They had a warning that something was going wrong when they looked up and they saw all these deer and rabbits and wild turkeys running out of the woods. And they're thinking, what in the heck is going on here? It's a stampede of all the wildlife that was in the woods. A few seconds later, they found out why all these animals were running out of the woods. They heard this shrill rebel yell that get louder and louder, finally came as a roar coming out of the woods. And then they saw this gray lion moving out of the woods and the glint of what sunlight was left on the rifle barrels and bayonets and these red flags, regimental flags waving. Now they found out why all the deer were running out of the woods. They were being driven out of the woods.
Yankee
it was like
deer.
A stampede. Yeah.
Running from like rebs.
They had recruited a lot of animals to help them out. So Jackson's Corps hit the 11th Corps and just totally wiped them out, overran them. And the problem was now it was getting late in the afternoon. The sun was going down. And the battle got really confused. The Confederate attack had been so sudden and so successful that now Confederate units and federal units were all mixed together. And it turned into just a, you know, pretty much a fist fight in the woods of who could fight out of this pocket and get away or who could launch an attack with this little small number of troops against where they were. And as it got later and later in the afternoon, it got darker and darker. Now, Jackson knew exactly what they needed to do. He wanted to continue the attack at night. He said, this is a golden opportunity. We got the Federal Army on the run. They've separated from the main part of the Federal Army. If we can drive through here and take these fords across the Rapidan River up north of where we are to our left, then we'll have the Federal Army cut off, and they will have to try to get across the river, fight their way across the river, or fall back on the rest of Hooker's army and be trapped between two wings of the Confederate Army. You can just destroy them piecemeal or at our leisure, pretty much. So he wanted to launch a night attack, but he had to find out exactly where the Federal Army was. So he and some of his staff rode out past Confederate lines to try to scout through the woods. Now, it was totally dark now, and they were trying to find out where the Federal Army was. It was dark. The woods were real thick. There were units moving back and forth, and nobody really knew exactly where they were. It was total confusion, and he was trying to get his army, his corps, organized and ready to finish off the Federal Army before they could get back across the Rapidan River, which is up north of them or to their left. And he made in military what was the cardinal mistake. He left the Confederate lines, went out scouting ahead, and he found out the Federals were digging in. There wasn't any way they were going to be successful with a night attack. So he turned around to come back to the Confederate lines. But being out in those woods at night with no guides, no landmarks to guide on, he turned around and came back to the Confederate lines in a different position from where he left. So the Confederates that were holding that part of the line didn't know that Jackson was out there in front of them. And he couldn't have picked a worse place in the Confederate lines to come back, because that North Carolina regiment just about a half an hour before that had been hit with Yankee cavalry. They drove them away, but they'd taken a lot of casualties. So now they heard horses coming up the road, the horses' hooves on the road, you know, the bridles and the leather, and, you know, horses make when you're riding them. They assumed it was Yankee cavalry that was coming back. They didn't order them to halt, who goes there, anything like that. They were just pretty sure this was Yankee cavalry coming back. The officers told them, ready, aim, fire, and they just cut loose on what they thought was Yankee cavalry, but it was Jackson and his staff. Two of his staff officers were killed outright. Jackson was wounded. He was hit by two bullets. His horse, Little Sorrel, was hit and panicked and took off the road, went under a low tree limb, and Jackson was literally knocked out of the saddle and off the back of the horse by this tree limb, hit the ground really hard. And now his staff officers were trying to convince the Confederates that you're firing on your own men. You're firing on your own men. They said the Yankee bastards are lying. Open fire on them again. So bullets were just flying through there. And now, further up the road, the Yankees heard all this shooting. They thought the Confederates were launching a night attack. So now they open fire. So Jackson and his wounded staff members and the dying horses were caught out between the lines, and bullets flying back and forth over their head from the Confederate lines going toward the Union lines and the Union lines going toward the Confederate lines. And finally, they got it calmed down enough they could get him on a stretcher and get General Jackson out of there. They took him to the doctor, Dr. Hunter McGuire. They amputated his left arm. There was a bullet in his right hand. That wasn't any big problem. They got that, dug that one out. But his left arm was shattered. And they didn't have the medical skill back then to go in and repair all the nerves and the bones and everything. So you got a serious wound like that, they just had to go up above the wound and amputate the limb, whether it was an arm or a leg. And they amputated his left arm. And he survived the operation. And there's one thing that I heard that really set me off. One of these so-called history experts that they had on CNN was talking about, well, about this time in the war, the Confederates were shooting their own generals. And I thought, you drooling idiot, this was not an assassination attempt. It was a horrible mistake. And, of course, when they said that, they proved right off the bat they didn't know anything at all about history to say that the Confederate soldiers tried to assassinate their own general. They had no idea who they were shooting at. Well, they had an idea. They thought they were shooting at Yankee cavalry because they heard the horses and just assumed the Yankees were coming back after her. So that was just a horrible accident. So Jackson survived the amputation of his arm. He was doing fairly well. Of course, he was taken miles away from the battle. And the problem was he got pneumonia. And back then, the worst thing you could do with someone with pneumonia was have him lay down. They need to have him up and walking around.
Yeah.
But we'll go back and give you the result of what happened when he came down with pneumonia and just after the break.
A sad story you have to go back to. We've got to do it, though. Be right back, folks.
Are you watching what's happening in our country and asking, what can I do? Join the John Birch Society in Salt Lake City, June 6th, for a powerful one-day conference. The day includes a host of respected speakers, two meals, and meaningful connections. You'll gain clarity on the issues and walk away with practical steps you can take to your community. Reserve your seat today at jbs.org/SLC26. That's jbs.org/SLC26.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing, and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Radio family, we had some great stuff in the breaks, but I got to shut up and go right back to the Bill Under himself.
Well, we're back to the Battle of Chancellorsville, and on May the 1st, Jackson's flank march took his second corps around the Federal Army and attacked the Federal Army on their right or western flank, overran them, and as the sun was going down and got confused at night, Jackson went out to try to find out where the Federal lines were and returning to the Confederate lines. And we said that was a cardinal sin. Once you go outside your lines, you always come back at the same place where you left because they know you're out there. And just like what happened that night in May of 1863, if you come back into another part of your lines, even though it's friendly troops, they don't know you're out there. And they see you coming back in, especially at night. In this situation, we said it couldn't have been at a worse place because that North Carolina regiment had been hit by Federal cavalry. They heard the horses out on the road, and they just cut loose on them and killed two of his staff officers in the first volley. And then they were caught out between the lines. The Yankees heard all the shooting. They thought the Confederates were launching a night attack, so they opened fire. And now some of Jackson's staff were laying on top of him to protect him, and bullets flying back and forth from right to left and left to right over their heads. We said that Jackson was wounded and his left arm shattered. Dr. Hunter McGuire operated and amputated his left arm. He survived that. But a couple of days later, he got pneumonia. And they thought back then, for pneumonia, you ought to rest up, but that was the worst thing that could happen. And when you're laying down, your lungs fill up with fluid. And Jackson died not from having his arm amputated, but from pneumonia. And the doctors then had no way to treat it. They didn't have penicillin or any of the drugs that we have today, but they could tell you almost to the hour when you were going to die. And they knew Jackson was dying, and they told him that, and his wife had come, Anna had come up there to be with him. And he said, well, he died. He was going to die. The next day was a Sunday. And he said, you know, I've always wanted to die on a Sunday. And so he did. And, of course, that was a terrible loss for the Confederates. And the Battle of Chancellorsville was going on while all of this was happening. Sedgwick and the Union forces crossed the Rappahannock River, went through the town of Fredericksburg. Finally, after taking serious losses, got up on Mary's Heights above Fredericksburg and drove the Confederates back away from their defensive position at Fredericksburg. So now Lee had the situation of Hooker's army, which had not been destroyed, out in front of him, and now Sedgwick's corps was closing in behind him. So he had to turn around and divide his army again and send part of them back to the east to fight Sedgwick while still holding off Hooker to the west. So he was able to do that. So he was fighting two battles at one time and stopped Sedgwick, and finally fighting Joe Hooker had had enough fighting. He decided to pull the Army of the Potomac together and get him back across the Rappahannock River and leave Lee alone. The end result was, just like you were talking about during the break, Eddie, you're a great military historian, that they lost one of their, the South lost one of their greatest generals in Thomas Jackson. They never had the offensive punch after the Battle of Chancellorsville like they had before. And that June, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July, they fought the Battle at Gettysburg. Well, Jackson wasn't there. He had passed away and died in May. And they split the army up into three army corps, one under James Longstreet, his old corps, one under Richard Ewell that commanded Jackson's second corps, and then they took a division from each one of their corps and made the third corps under A.P. Hill. Since they didn't have the offensive weapon that they had under Jackson, they thought they'd break it up a little more. Well, as we will probably mention even more in July when we get to Gettysburg, July 1st, Confederates once again caught Howard's 11th Corps and caught them in a vise with Confederates coming down from the north. They'd been up to York, Pennsylvania, and then the rest of A.P. Hill's Corps coming up the road from Chambersburg and routed the Federal Army off the field on July the 1st. And then Longstreet delayed and didn't do this and didn't do that, never took the little round tops at the southern end of the Federal line on Cemetery Ridge until he tried an attack. He was supposed to launch an attack at 8 o'clock in the morning, didn't do it till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And by then, the Federals had reinforced the little round top and Cemetery Ridge. Confederates weren't able to drive them off. And then on the July 3rd, as a really desperate gamble, they launched three divisions across this open ground over a mile and a half and tried to break the center of the Federal line on Cemetery Ridge. There were actually three different divisions that were in that, about 15,000, but it was called Pickett's Charge because most of the newspapers were printed in Virginia and they gave George Pickett the credit for it. But there were actually two other divisions along with his, and of course that was defeated, and both armies sat there and looked at each other on July the 4th, and then the night of July 4th, Lee began the retreat back to Virginia. But they never had the offensive power that they had while Thomas Jackson was there. And then the next May, Grant had taken over the Army of the Potomac, and Lee had to fight defensive battles at the Wilderness, Spotsylvania, Hanover Courthouse, Cold Harbor, and finally they were forced back into the trenches around Richmond and Petersburg. And then it was just a war of attrition, just keep stretching the lines out further and further and stretching the Confederates out further and further to defend the railroads coming into Richmond and Petersburg for supplies, but they didn't have enough people to cover that much ground. And that was pretty much the end of it. Finally, in April of 65, they had to pull out of Richmond and the retreat going west toward the mountains. And as we all know, they were cut off at a place called Appomattox Courthouse and forced to surrender. So anyway, a lot of people, historians have said that the Battle at Chancellorsville was Lee's greatest victory and what he did of dividing his army in the face of a much larger army and then actually launching attacks against them. And the losses were heavy. Besides losing Thomas Jackson, Well, the losses on the U.S. side, they lost 17% of their 133,000, but the Confederates lost 22% of their 60,000. So they took some horrific losses, and the South just couldn't replace the losses. I was looking up the today, going over it, and trying to get the statistics on all of that. The federal loss is about 17,200. The Confederates lost 12,800, but that was a lot higher percentage of their 60,000. So out of 12,000 losses, the Confederates probably couldn't replace but about, you know, maybe 700 or 800, while the federal army, bringing all the Irish and German immigrants here, could not only replace their losses, but even make their army even that much larger. And that's what Grant had the next May. He had an army of about 120,000, and Lee had an army of about only about 40,000 to face 120,000. So he still was able. Now, Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia had to fight these defensive battles and try to outmarch Grant and figure out where Grant was going and take up defensive positions to stop him. And like I said, we maybe next week we can talk about some of the Wilderness campaign against Lee and Grant in Virginia and what happened there. But they were strictly on the defensive from there on to the end of the war. So I hope that will give our listeners a little bit of information on what happened in May of 1863. And then maybe next week we can pick up May again and we'll get into the Wilderness campaign, that, as it was called, between Lee and Grant. Grant had the advantage of superior numbers. And in the Wilderness campaign, Grant lost more men as killed, wounded, and missing in action than Lee had in his entire army. God, and yet Lee. Grant still had a much larger army at the end of the campaign than Lee had. But one of those battles was in June at a place called Cold Harbor, and Grant got tired of trying to keep marching around Lee's army and getting between Lee and Richmond. He just decided to launch these suicide attacks against the Confederate position. And the Confederates were in a kind of a concave line, so the federal attacks had to come into these areas where now they had the Confederates firing at them from the front, from the left, and the right. And they took over 7,000 casualties in 20 minutes. That's how brutal. Yeah, it wasn't enough. You're right.
I wish it had been 70,000.
Yeah.
I guess that makes me brutal.
But that's what Grant did. He had no concern for his men. He didn't care how many of them got killed because they could replace them. And the thing was, after they took all those casualties and they'd ordered one attack right after another and they just kept getting mowed down and mowed down and mowed down, he finally called it off. And there were thousands of these dead and wounded federal soldiers outside the Confederate earthworks. And they were crying and begging for help and water. This is in June. It was hot. And they were laying out there. And so some of the Confederates climbed over their earthworks and were taking canteens out to them to try to help these guys. They felt sorry for them. They'd been trying to kill them, and now these poor wounded guys were laying out there hollering for help. And the federal soldiers were ordered to shoot the Confederates that were out in the open. And so here were enemy soldiers that were trying to help them. They were ordered to shoot them, so they couldn't. So each night they said they could hear fewer and fewer of them crying for help, and finally most of the ones that were out there died after 3 days. So anyway, that was also in May. We'll get back to that next week.
Well, I surely want to thank you, Bitterender, for coming on. You did a marvelous job. Next time I'd like to comment about that being our far, in a way, the bloodiest war the United States ever been in. And it makes me want to cry every time I see some ignorant son of a bitch salute that Yankee flag. I tell these people that Yankee flag, you're living here in the United States in occupied territory, a territory that was taken at the point of the bayonet. I better shut up. I guess we're completely out of time. But I can't wait to get you back on again next week, Gene.
Okay, Eddie. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Miss Lizzie. Thank you, Blood River Radio family. We'll see you, God willing, same time, same place next week. Good night, y'all.